Okay, good afternoon. Order, please. Order. Okay, we're going to the next presentation. Will be received from Mr. Malachi Kanyani. From Malachi Kanyani Incorporated, and it will be led by Mr. T. Malachi. just a bit of a challenge for us. There are going to be changes to our program. We're supposed to be getting presentations this afternoon from Fedusa Nastu. Because of time, I think Nastu is, they're not able to, because they're rushing for a flight. They have, however, submitted their what they were going to present to us. Members did receive their submissions, written submission earlier on, and this is in addition to that submission. So it's a minus one for now. We're going to be moving because of the National Assembly plenary. We're going to be moving closer to plenary because we have three bills that we need to vote for. And for us to be part of that voting, we have to be closer. So we're going to be changing venue after this particular presentation to the nearest one to the chamber. So that movement will start immediately after you, after the presentation. Without any further waste of time, may I give the opportunity to Mr. Malachi? That's the only name I received. I can see you are two. May I give you the opportunity to introduce this beautiful lady next to you?
Thank you, Chair. My name is Teboho Malachi. I'm a director at Malachi Kanyani Incorporated, a law firm in Sandton. Sitting next to me is my colleague, also director of the same firm, Bonang Masia, and she is more acquainted with the space competition law than I am, Masia. What we'll be doing is we have prepared a presentation. If the technical team could just assist with projecting. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you all our submissions, having submitted written ones. We structured our presentation first to start with just giving focus to what this submission will be speaking to. And then we will tackle section 8, abuse of dominance, with some specific contentious issues there. My colleague Bonham will tackle section 15, 16, and 17, consideration of measure and revocation of approval. I'll then tackle an interesting section 8, chapter 8, intervention in foreign in measures involving foreign claims, and then we'll conclude with some different remarks. In far as the focus of our presentation is concerned, we thought the memorandum on the objects of the bill speaks quite volumes of what the bill seeks to achieve, being to address two persistent structural constraints of the South Kenya economy, namely high levels of economic concentration in the economy and still the ownership profile of the economy. We also thought it apt to quote Honorable Minister Ibrahim Patel when he introduced the bill to the committee, and the particular extract that we thought speaks to our focus on submissions is, quote, "The amendments also strengthen the available interventions that may be undertaken to redress the specific challenges posed by concentration and untransformed ownership." As a starting point, Honorable Chair, we stay clear of competition in economics, and our focus will be to support proposed amendments which we have highlighted in our submission insofar as we seek to advance public interest. We do not deal with competition economics matters, but we make legal submissions, especially in relation to some of the criticism that has been leveled against some of the amendments. If we look at section 8, and we follow the approach that says you build up the argument that is out there, and then you knock it down, that will be our approach in relation to this presentation. So the first specific criticism is around what is referred to as a reverse owner, as proposed in section 8.2. There is also then concern about the powers of the Commission to publish guidelines regarding calculation and determination of an excessive price under the proposed section 8.3.4 and 8.4. There's also a complaint that there might be a blurring of power, which is required by our constitution, for the executive to be separated from you as the legislator, to be separated from the judiciary. So there's a criticism that in enacting these provisions, there will be an encroachment on the separation of power doctrine, you know, entrenched in our constitution. Now, looking at the first criticism, the concern that I raised is what amounts to a prima facie case being made out. It is quite clear from our reading that there doesn't seem to be a problem with a reverse honor. Reverse honor being circumstances where the law says the person accused of wrongdoing shall be responsible.
Sorry, ladies. We are in a meeting.
Thank you, Chair. In our law, there's nothing wrong with what is called a reverse owner. In other words, there's a certain set of facts that are presented, and when those facts are presented, they prove a particular event, if uncontroverted. In classic cases, law of defamation, if you publish a statement about another person which tarnishes their name, then the law says that statement is per se defamation because of its nature, and you, the person who uttered or made that particular statement, must then offer and present evidence to show that perhaps the statement made was true of the person that you made it about, and the onus is on you, the person that made the statement, as opposed to the person that's suing for defamation. So there's nothing unusual about that. But we gather that there isn't much complaint around Rivet Corner, but for the concern that they've raised, which goes along the following line. At what point during the tribunal proceedings would a firm be able to know, and the tribunal itself, to determine that a prima facie case has been met? Now, we say, in response to this particular criticism, that the threshold is clear, prima facie. What does prima facie mean? Prima facie means that the commission must be in possession of facts which, if objectively proven, without contradiction, would constitute an abuse of dominance set out in Section 8. So put differently, there will be facts supported by statements, affidavits, documents, which on the face of it, if uncontroverted, would constitute prima facie evidence of a contravention. Then there's a second issue around that the commission, having power to publish guidelines, does this mean the guidelines then have some force of law, as would the Competition Act and its regulation? We say no, that isn't so. The new proposed section 794 specifically provides that the guidelines are not binding. We make the point that if one has regard to the hierarchy of our laws in the Republic, the Constitution is always the supreme, followed by legislation passed by Parliament and the provincial legislature.
We are looking for this particular presentation. The one we have here does not correlate with this. The one on the screen. Do you probably have copies of
this? Chair, no. We actually emailed them earlier this morning too.
This morning?
Yeah. I'm sure he had already left office.
Yeah, unfortunately he was out of the office to hear.
Yeah. If I can just clarify, what we've done is we've moved from the premise that you do have the written submission and that you have had regard to them. What we are attempting to do today is to augment those written submissions with specific aspects from a legal perspective that you are going to encounter as you deliberate on them.
Not necessarily changing anything about your submission.
No, there isn't anything that we're changing about the submission. We're just highlighting specific areas of the proposed amendment, which we have previously commented on, and we're just augmenting and highlighting some of the legal questions that have been put out there and queries.
It's good that we are not going to interact with this presentation immediately after.
Yes.
We're going to go to vote, and then when we get there, we will, after the change of venue, we will then be able to interact with you. In that process, Peter Paul would have made the copy of your presentation.
Okay.
Thank you. I hope it's okay with you. Is it okay with you? Okay. Alright, you may proceed.
Now our point is the complaint about the Commission's power to publish guidelines is not meritorious, in the sense that a guideline is exactly that. It's issued by a public functionary or a body, and it doesn't apply the status of law. Law in the form of either legislation or common law or the Constitution itself must be rigidly followed. So in other words, those who are charged with performing public functions and exercising public power must make sure that their conduct falls within the four corners of that particular law. A guideline is not law. It's not rigid. And we've seen it in many other places as well. To give you an example, in the regulation of professions, health professions, the Health Professions Council of Africa will issue guidelines for practitioners to have regard to say, well, am I acting within the bounds of ethical conduct or not if I were to do X, Y, or Z? And the guideline will say, well, if you were to do it this way, you're fine. If you do it that way, you might have difficulty. But it doesn't mean that they're going to apply that guideline in determining guilt or not. The same applies there. We say all that the Commission will be doing is to give an indication of how it is likely to apply itself to a particular set of facts, and so that people have some reference points and some guidelines on conduct out there in the market. And more specifically, as we say in section 79, it's clear that new 79 shows clear that the guidelines are not binding. In accordance with case law, we maintain, therefore, that guidelines are merely provide pessimistic explanations in relation to the interpretation application of constitutional provisions. In the text, words, for instance, there's quite a number of practice notes that get issued by the Revenue Service, in the same way that National Treasury also issues practice notes to various public entities and departments. And those are not hard and fast, they are simply guidance for those who must apply themselves to the law. So we say, respecting the wording in 3, 4, and 8, 4, it is quite clear that the guideline has no force of law. The guidelines will have no force of law. And I'll hand over to my colleague, Mona, to deal with section 16 and 18.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. As the board has already said, I'm going to be dealing with these specific provisions only. There's been some criticism levels in relation to merger provisions, specifically regarding the new sections on merger revocation, and the concern there, the nub of the concern is that the particular provisions themselves render the Commission and the Tribunal, when they relook at a merger which they have already approved, whether with conditions or without conditions, they render that merger, they render the Commission and the Tribunal revisiting it to be functus officio. Now, this doctrine of functus officio, if I can explain it, it essentially sets out that once an administrator, such as the competition authorities, give a final decision on a merger, they cannot reverse it or alter it, they cannot revisit it. This doctrine is sound. We support the doctrine in the sense that, you know, it creates finality, there's no uncertainty. If a party to a merger has to rely on that decision, they can do so. If they can act upon it, they can do so. Now, if the competition authorities come back and they revisit it, it creates some level of uncertainty, and this is what the criticism is about. We say the criticism fails, though, because this rule, the functus rule, it's not absolute. It's a general rule, and like every general rule, there are exceptions to it. There's an exception that's been created against the functus rule by our court, recognizing the fact that administrators themselves cannot be bogged down by things that are inflexible. So if there is cause for revisiting a decision that's already been made, particularly in circumstances where the legislature does allow for that, provided that it is fair, in other words, you know, it can't be applied in a capricious manner, so there has to be some fairness to it. If the Commission comes back or the Tribunal itself reuses this order, it has to consider what the merging parties put to them. So in this sense, the functus rule, we say it's not absolute, and in the instance it's contemplated in our amendment, and if I can just go to the specific amendment in question. It's section 15.1b and section 16.3b. 15.1b itself allows the Commission to make any appropriate decision in regards to public interest matters. So there is a situation which may arise where the merging parties, for instance, were obliged to provide employment opportunities in respect of specific groups, and they have to maintain that level. And then new information arises much later after the merger has been approved that, in fact, the merged entity can afford to up the employment level. then in that instance the commission of course is entitled to revisit it, because it would have looked at factors at that specific point, and then new information arises. So we support the fact that the new provisions are included in the proposed amendments. And similarly with regards to the tribunal itself, if it was given information that at the time, you know, it didn't take into account certain issues, it can reason the public interest considerations that their decision was based on. So now I move. There's another concern in regards to the mergers themselves, which has been raised, and it's in relation to Section 17, which talks about the right of the Commission as well as the Minister to have a right of appeal. Currently, the current Principal Act, as it reads, it doesn't allow for the Minister to have a right of appeal, and we say that's unfortunate. So we welcome the current proposal to say the Minister must have a right of appeal, particularly because the Minister's interests, surely they must outweigh the interests of the merging parties, because not because he's the Minister, but because he is seized with ensuring that public interest considerations are taken into account. Now, the criticism is that there will be uncertainty if the Minister is allowed to appeal. That process, you know, legal processes are quite lengthy. So there won't be any certainty and finality towards the merging parties, because their business interests are going to be hampered. We say the Minister must be afforded the same opportunity as the merging parties. If the merging parties can appeal the decision by the tribunal, he must also have that opportunity to do so. Equally so with the Commission. There was a suggestion that, you know, he can take the decision on review instead of an appeal process, but ultimately it may end up in the same time frame. And at any rate, you know, the right of review is there, is a given, it's provided for under PAJA. So whereas right of appeal must be legislated, so the Minister must have that opportunity to do so. So this criticism is really unmeritorious. We feel that it's there for the sake of being there. The Minister must have a right of appeal.
May I help you? Unfortunately, we have to advise that they just didn't put it to us now. Can we continue at G26? Is it now E249? E249, second floor, National Assembly. With our apologies, we did not anticipate this. It wasn't in the program before. We just received this after we have finalized our program.
With your permission, could we get an indication of how long you'd like it to be added? We've already moved
out once. It doesn't take long.
So online, half an hour.
No, it's been half an hour. Okay. If you allow us now, okay. It won't even be half an hour. You just have to be there in time, and then what you take, I think within